I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Angela Tomasky's novel, The Infamous Gilberts, opens with a house tour of the fictional Thornwalk Manor, led by Maximus, a neighbor who knows all the ins and outs of the Gilbert family, of which there are five siblings. Through this tour by Maximus, we learn about each of the Gilberts, from childhood through late adulthood, sometimes through artifacts left behind in the house. I recently spoke with Angela Tomasky about her original use of perspective and some of the dark issues that haunt the characters. Here's our conversation. So who are the infamous Gilberts of the title? Could you introduce us to them and to Thornwalk?
Yeah, so the infamous Gilberts, it refers to the five Gilbert siblings who grow up in this crumbling Gothic mansion with their mother. Thornwalk is a big neo-Gothic mansion. It was based on a beautiful real house, Tinsfield, which is near Bristol in Somerset. So
we meet the Gilberts by way of Maximus, who is giving the reader a tour of Thornwalk, which is about to be or has been sold to a hotel chain. And I have a couple of questions about this. And the first relates to structure, because the chapters have titles like The Bolt on the Blue Room Door and A Button Between the Floorboards and The Library Request Slip. The story of the Gilberts is revealed through these shorter stories explaining how these things came to be at Thornwalk. Can you talk to me about this idea, you know, to use relics to tell a complete story by providing context?
Yes, well, I think that we do often come across stories that way. As we're walking around our own environment, we see things, you know, tangible objects that spark memories. So I'm looking at that. I'm thinking of Maximus as a real person in a real house, coming across these objects and seemingly inconsequential little things that carry meaning. I think often it's these little things that are so important to us. I remember as a child having a little box of a thread and a jelly bear, little tiny things that meant something to me, a blade of grass that I'd taken from the school playground and then couldn't put down again. And these were more precious to me than many of the other things around me. They really mattered to me. In terms of the book, I actually went on a tour of Tinsfield and saw the bed, the sort of deathbed of the last, you know, man that had lived there. And of course, that was very quickly removed by the National Trust, who had just bought this house. But I felt that so much atmosphere and so many ideas were conjured by this simple, very simple bed. And it was such a shame that it was lost, and it was sort of lost for good. So that's where the idea came from. So the combination of those two things, my experiences as a child and this view of this bed.
So did you have a list of what items in the house we'd be introduced to, or did they come to you as you were writing?
They came to me as I was writing, I think the majority of them, yes. I wanted some to be really kind of thrilling, like the sort of the cracked door, those sorts of things, you know, the bolt on the door, things that would sort of raise a sort of question in the mind of the reader, things that would seem interesting or dramatic somehow. But other things, I think I just sort of, you know, in my mind and my imagination, I sort of walked through the house and found these things. There were obviously certain things I wanted to say, and I sort of thought about, you know, what would be the best object to tell this story? What would really encapsulate that event or that idea or the character best, you know, in some way?
So the second question relates to perspective and point of view. Maximus speaks directly to the reader, guiding us on a tour of the property, addressing the reader as you. How did you choose this perspective?
Well, it was a number of different things that I played with. I just felt it would be engaging. It would sort of bring the reader in. Initially, I had the idea of referring to you, but having that as an actual person who was sort of visiting the house, who might actually pick up the manuscript. So in a way, it's just one step beyond that, because there's no, you know, there is a book that the reader has picked up. So it was that, really. And I felt that sort of, you know, Maximus, you know, if he felt he was talking to an actual person sort of directly, that sort of conversational tone would come in and he could really be himself in that environment, you know.
Well, Max comes across as, you know, an omniscient narrator at times. He does admit that he wasn't present for everything and sometimes relies on what he's been told or what he's read in diaries. Do you consider him reliable?
Yes, I do. I think he tries to tell the truth. I think it's important to him to tell the truth. This is his one opportunity to say everything. And I think because he really loves them, he really loves these siblings, and he doesn't judge them, I don't think he's scared to tell everything he knows. I think he's really keen to do that. And I think he wants the reader to love them as he does. But I think he wants the reader to love these siblings as they are, and not to hide anything, but to still be lovable. And I think they are. I love them. And with all their flaws and all their eccentricities, I think he understands, you know, why they came to be as they were, why they came to behave as they do. And he loves them anyway.
The stories we learn about this family, they jump around a lot in time, you know, from the 1930s to the 70s. I think I remember the 80s and the 90s, perhaps, maybe even beyond that. Some of what happened to these characters, I wonder if it was a product of the time of misunderstanding. Like, was Hugo's perceived madness really PTSD? Or, you know, I won't say what was done to Annabelle, but she was considered an imbecile, yet she seemed the most solid and sane among the bunch to me. Do you think the Gilberts were misunderstood?
I think with Annabelle, she was a victim of that sort of normalizing sort of social pressures. She behaved in an unusual way, yes, as you say, for the time. And what happened was sort of, you know, another family member sort of steps in. And because the love wasn't there, you know, things were able to happen to Annabelle that really shouldn't have happened. With Hugo, I think, yes, there's part of that PTSD with his experiences in the war, but also the pressures of responsibility, of taking on a role that he wasn't equipped for. So, I mean, all the issues spring from the primary aim of the book, which was to explore the effects of, you know, fatherlessness, the absent father figure. So that's the primary cause, as I see it, of these forms of behavior, these problems that these siblings encounter.
This question is about timing again, but it's more about craft this time. Did you write this chronologically from when the Gilberts were children up through adulthood, or did you jump around in time as it does in the text and on the tour?
Yes, I wrote it as it appears in the book. So it was very much following Maximus, just being Maximus. And, you know, I had played with this story for 20 years. You know, it was 20 years since I'd been to the house, been to Tinsfield. And so I knew the story really well. And I knew the characters really well and the place really well. So I was able to just sort of write it as it appears.
There were a few ideas I noted, nuggets about life, and these are quotes from the book. To be able to love is a luxury. That's why it is always balanced exactly with loss. It is another of life's great justices. And then also, yes, life drives us all to madness, or it should. People who stay sane haven't been doing it properly. So this poignant tone permeates throughout the book. What did you want to explore here?
Well, in those instances, I think it's those examples, it's about love. So as I mentioned before with Maximus, this fact that they can behave the way they do and there can be great distance, physical distance between the siblings, but, you know, love is there at the end, and that's the strongest thing. That's the thing we remember. Life drives us all to madness. Well, I think it does. I think it's driven me to madness anyway. I think if we fully engage with things, if we, you know, if we really look at, around us at the people we love and the way that they have suffered, I think it's really, really hard to bear. That's all really.
I felt like the idea of being a hero was present throughout the book, or am I imagining that?
With Hugo? Do you mean with Hugo?
It felt like Hugo. It felt like Jeremy. I mean, I just felt like I was highlighting hero a lot throughout the book.
Well, I think Maximus, you know, particularly loves Hugo. They're obviously very close and spending a lot of time together at the end. And it's through Hugo that he is aware mainly of the other siblings, I think, often. And, you know, Hugo has the weight of the responsibility for the family. So with the absent father, So he wanted to be a hero early on, obviously, with some things that he does, you know, with the cows in the stream. I think he desperately wanted to be a hero, and he desperately wanted to save the family. He wanted to save the house. So Hugo, yes, the idea of him being a hero, I think that was so important to him. And the idea that he was sort of was struggling to do that, and he was so ill-equipped for this role that had been passed to him. And I think that hopefully, you know, someone, you know, Maximus, you know, knows that and he understands that. And so he has such compassion for Hugo.
You mentioned earlier that you love all of these Gilberts. Was there one in particular that was more fun to explore their storyline?
Well, I think Hugo, because he can become so dark and so he's quite exaggerated character in some ways in his behavior. He has such intensities of emotion, you know, that heroic spirit that you sort of saw. And then when that's thwarted and the despair that comes with that. So he's very high and low. And so I had fun playing with that. And then, you know, the compassion that comes through at the end, his love for, you know, the woodlice in the kitchen and little things like that. I think he has great capacity to love. So, yes, I'm very fond of Hugo.
Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
I don't know, really. I hope they would enjoy it, you know, just that they'd enjoy spending time in this beautiful house as I did, you know, enjoy, you know, spending time with these siblings and watching them try. And perhaps, you know, I'm hoping that a reader will identify the cause of their problems and have compassion for them and have perhaps, you know, more compassion perhaps for others who display, you know, similar behaviors, you know, this idea of life driving us to madness. And we talk about that a lot. We say, oh, you know, it's okay to express your, you know, your mental health, you know, problems. But how does that actually manifest itself in real life? We are so cautious around people who behave in an unusual way. Of course, we are wary of any sort of violence, you know, but these things come from somewhere, you know, and selfishness can come from people whose, you know, if their needs haven't been met, they often turn inwards, that they determined to meet their own needs, can become quite selfish. And these people, we're not really drawn to people who behave like that, and, you know, quite rightly in many ways. But if we're going to start talking about it, you know, it's okay to, you know, that, you know, problems with mental health are so widespread, and it's okay to talk about them and, you know, to have compassion for people like that. You know, how does that manifest in our behavior towards other people on a daily basis? You know, how accepting are we of difference and ourselves, you know, that it's okay to be struggling and we don't have to lock it all inside, you know. And also, it's dedicated to my cat Kitgenstein, and I was hoping that maybe other people would think that was a great name and would call their cats Kitgenstein, and there would maybe be many cats called Kitgenstein.
I'll have to reconsider that for my next cat, because my cat's name is Cat. Very unimaginative.
Well, I often just called mine Kitten.
Well, the book is The Infamous Gilberts. Angela Tomasky, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Infamous Gilberts by Angela Tomasky was published by Scribner. Up next, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a debut novel that explores some odd corners of the internet.
Lior Torenberg's debut novel, Just Watch Me, follows a 20-something woman who starts a live stream marathon to raise money for her little sister, who is in a coma. Our main character, Del Danvers, is a mess, having dropped out of school at NYU and been fired from her job at a juice bar. She can't pay for her tiny New York apartment, which is a converted closet and doesn't even have a bathroom. She can't pay for her burgeoning student loans. She cannot afford a doctor visit to see about her perpetual stomach pain. She tries to make money selling plant propagations to trust fund kids, but even that venture doesn't pan out the way she wants it to. So she impulsively launches a 24-hour live stream under the username Mademoiselle Dell, and we are soon dropped into the fascinating subculture of online streamers and their loyal audiences. When Dell realizes that provocative content translates to more money, She starts proposing crazier and crazier schemes to keep people watching and clicking the donate button. When she eats several habanero peppers on camera, she sees the donations come pouring in, and she also catches the attention of a well-known streamer known for his spicy food escapades. And that's where the novel takes a heated and propulsive turn. Torenberg's publisher pitches it as Fleabag meets Big Swiss, but I think a better comp might be Margot's Got Money Troubles meets Hot Ones. The scenes involving spicier and spicier pepper eating are scary, grueling, stressful, and perfectly paced. Dell is a flawed and inherently believable character, a struggling young woman who can be both selfish and selfless. She makes poor decisions. She treats her online audience with rude snarkiness. And despite it all, you can't help rooting for her. When one of her online viewers crosses the line from fan to troll, Dell has to navigate his threats while trying to maintain her growing audience and lucrative business. With taut writing and vivid dialogue, Torenberg explores parasocial relationships, sibling guilt, and the fine line between fame and loneliness. Torenberg divides her book into 7 chapters, one for each day of Dell's live stream. The author says she conceived the novel during the pandemic lockdown, when so many people turned to online relationships to find solace and company. And that research is evident here, with characters that tug at your heart as they struggle to feel cared for and loved. Throughout the novel, we're not quite sure how Dell's sister ended up in a coma. Torenberg manages to unpack that at just the right pace, offering details through flashbacks and other literary devices until a conclusion that's both surprising and satisfying. Don't let the bizarre premise fool you. Just Watch Me is an intense, quirky novel that delivers in a big way, a bold and spicy debut. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Just Watch Me by Lior Torenberg was published by Avid Reader Press and Simon & Schuster Audio. Joining us now from Milwaukee, Wisconsin is David Malman, publisher rep for W.W. Norton & Company. I've asked Dave to join us because he's one of the most well-read individuals I know, and he reads far beyond his own imprint. He's here to talk about new books, forthcoming titles, and works he just can't stop thinking about. Welcome to Marginalia, Dave.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
I'm so excited to hear about the books you brought for us today. What do you have on your stack to talk about?
All right. Well, I'll start with a few books from last year that I really loved. They were on my 10 best books of the year. The first, which made a lot of best of lists, but I don't think enough people read it, is called The Sisters by Jonas Hassan Kamari. He is a Swedish writer, but this is his first book in English. And it revolves around, as you might expect, a group of sisters who grow up with something of what they see as a curse on their lives that affects them. And he follows their lives from their childhood all the way up to the present. And he knows them because he lived in the same neighborhood as them in Sweden. But now he is in the United States writing his first book in English at the New York Public Library. And so the main character is very much like the author. The structure of the book is really fascinating. There are 7 sections. Each one covers a shorter length of time. So the first section covers 1 year, the second 6 months, the third 3 months, all the way down to 1 month, 1 week, 1 day, and the last section covers 1 minute. And it's an extremely affecting book. You get to know all of these characters. They're all so fascinating. The narrator is funny and odd, and you just want to get to know him. He's great. It's a big book. It's, you know, close to 700 pages, I think, or just over 600. But it was probably my favorite novel of 2025. And again, that was The Sisters by Jonas Hassan Kamari.
You know, we are in a short story group together that meets every 2 weeks on Zoom. And I think you have mentioned that book during every meeting of the last, you know, several months.
Yeah, and it did make the New York Times top 10 this
nice.
2025. So that was great.
All right, what else do you have?
Well, since you mentioned short stories, I'm going to mention my favorite short story collection of 2025, which got a lot of great reviews, but I don't think many people know about it. It's called Are You Happy? By Laurie Ostlund, O-S-T-L-U-N-D. And these stories are for people who like, you know, the classic kind of Alice Munro story where The stories are on the long side and they feel like miniature novels, and you get into the lives of all the characters. And I just could not stop reading this book. At least a couple of the books have been featured in Best American Short Stories, one of my favorite story collections in recent years. And again, that's Are You Happy by Laurie Ostlund.
Very nice. What else do you have?
The last one I'll talk about from last year is Life and Death and Giants by Ron Rindo. This was one of my favorite books of last year. And also, full disclosure, the author, Ron Rindo, was my writing mentor when I was an undergraduate 30 years ago at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh, where he just retired. The story is about a boy who is born with giantism. He's an enormous baby and becomes an enormous human being. At the point where he reaches his late teenage years, he's close to 8 feet tall. The story is narrated by a group of people in the small town in the Amish community where the child was born. And the book becomes not so much about this boy, Gabriel, the giant, as it is about the community that he impacts just by being born into that group of people. It's funny and odd and beautifully written. It's been tagged by some people as magical realism. It really is not. Giantism is a real thing that people really can have. And there's nothing magical about it, but it feels like it. And the ending is just kind of jaw-dropping. And again, that's Life and Death and Giants. The title comes from a Emily Dickinson poem, and the author is Ron Rindo.
You know, our book critic, Suzanne Perez, that was one of her favorite books of last year, too.
Yeah, I think I recommended it to
Probably so.
her.
Okay, what else?
So, a couple of things I am reading right now. A new book by a debut author. Her name is Sarah Maurer, Maurer. It's called A Good Animal. And it is set in rural Upper Peninsula, Michigan, in the town of Sault Ste. Marie. And it's set on a sheep farm. And our main character is the eldest son of this sheep farming family. He's close to finishing high school. He plans to basically stay where he is and be a farmer his entire life. But a young woman comes to the area. Her father's in the Coast Guard, so she moves around a lot, and he falls for her. Her name is Mary. And they have a relationship, and he starts to wonder if, he can make things work with this girl who the last thing she wants is to stay in Sault Ste. Marie. It's really beautifully written. If you like rural stories with great sort of down-to-earth characters, it's a really impressive debut. And again, that's A Good Animal by Sarah Maurer.
Okay.
Next, a book by Sarah Levine. She wrote a book years ago called Treasure Island with, I think, three exclamation points. And now this is her second book. It's called The Hitch. And it's from Roxane Gay Books. And it is about a woman who is tasked with taking care of her nephew for a brief time while his parents are away. And she knows everything. She is right about everything, and including parenting, even though she doesn't have kids. So she knows this is going to be a piece of cake. She and her nephew are out at a dog park, and her giant dog attacks and kills a corgi at the dog park. And after that, the nephew starts acting very strange, talking to himself, doing all kinds of odd things. And she's thinking that it's grief over this dog that he saw killed at the dog park. And the boy says, no, the dog wasn't killed. Essentially, he contends that the dog's soul has leapt into his body, and he is now the corgi. And she has to figure out how on earth to get through this situation and get her nephew back to normal before she has to hand him back to her parents. Sarah Levine is a very, very funny writer. This book is just so much fun, and her language is incredible. She is, I guess, what you'd say, a literary writer, even though it's kind of a crackpot, weird sort of plot. So, again, that's The Hitch by Sarah Levine.
Suzanne just reviewed that last week, so you two are like-minded with your book selections.
Oh, how about that?
Let's see if this next one matches.
All right. The next one is a book that we at W.W. Norton are publishing in January. It's called Every Exit Brings You Home by Naeem Moore. And it is the story of a Palestinian couple living in a rundown condo complex in Chicago. The husband of the couple, who goes by Jack, is the condo association president. And so he's constantly talking to all the people in the condos about all of their grievances and everything they think needs to be fixed. He also works as an airline steward for a major airline in his day job. And for reasons even he's not quite sure about, when he is with his fellow employees at the airline, he has them convinced that he is a gay man with a partner, which he is not. He is a married man with a wife who desperately wants to have a child. And it goes back and forth between his story as this airline steward and his story in the condos. And you get to know his coworkers, the other condo people, and everybody is just so well drawn, every character. It's one of those books that you, at some point in the book, you want to hug and strangle every single character in the book. It's funny, but in the end, it's so moving. It's just a beautiful novel, and it's getting really, really great early reviews. So I'm looking forward to people discovering this one. It's called Every Exit Brings You Home by Naeem Moore.
Very good.
Because I do like to read a fair amount of nonfiction, I thought I'd mention a couple. And I am drawn to philosophy. I was an English and philosophy major, and I think philosophy gets a bad rap as being the kind of book that, people don't want to read because it's too difficult or too obscure. So there's a couple. One of them we published at Live Right, which is an imprint of Norton, by Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, who is one of my favorite modern philosophers, also has written some really great novels. And it's called The Mattering Instinct: How Our Deepest Longing Drives and Divides Us. And she makes the case, a lot of people often say, what sets humans apart from the rest of the animal kingdom? She makes the case, and it's very convincing, that we are the only animal who thinks about, stews about, ponders why and how we matter, and that this mattering instinct is what drives us both to do good and to do bad. And what makes her so great is she is a funny, warm writer. It's not the kind of read you think of when you think about reading a book of philosophy. It's a lot of fun to read and really fascinating. So again, that's The Mattering Instinct by Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. And then a book that I just read that just came out in January called The Score: How to Stop Playing Somebody Else's Game by C.T. Nguyen. This one's published by Penguin Press. And C.T. Nguyen is a philosopher who specializes in games, which is a big thing in philosophy these days. What games mean, why we play them, and how that relates to life. And like Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, he is so much fun to read. He's very down to earth. He curses quite a bit in this book. He's quite funny at times. But the reasons we play games often are what lead us to try to, quote unquote, gamify real life, right? Apply scores to things and figure out who is best at what by ranking and things like that. You think of GPAs or college rankings or anything like that is kind of a way to gamify real life. And he says that the way that we keep score and make rules in games is what makes games so delightful. But to apply that same thing to real life can actually have disastrous results. This is just scratching the surface of what he talks about in this book. I found this book utterly, utterly fascinating and so much fun to read. I highly recommend it to anyone, even if you don't think you're interested in philosophy. And again, that's The Score: How to Stop Playing Somebody Else's Game by C.T. Nguyen.
This conversation has been edited for time. You can find all of Dave's recommendations at kmuw.org. David Malman with WW Norton, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you again for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.